GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit JLTUS.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Hey, I'm your host for GreenSense.
And I'm Bob Kessler, your executive producer.
We explore environmental issues, learn about sustainable innovations, and meet passionate people that are changing the world. What a great job.
It is a good job, but their ideas do have to make economic and common sense to get on the show.
And I make sure that they make environmental sense. Who do we have this week?
You know, most of us just have to walk a few feet, if that, to get clean water. But many, many people around the world have to walk something like 3 miles every day just to get clean water. World Vision's doing a special event coming up in May to highlight that rather alarming statistic. So we'll talk with them. Also, 15% of cars could be self-driving in the next 13 years or so. Does that sound really, really soon? It's pretty amazing when you think about it. Well, there's a new study that says that's what's going to happen. So we'll delve into that and we'll kick things off with Tom Appel of Consumer Guide Automotive and his Green Automotive News. That'll be first.
GreenSense starts off in high gear with Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, with some green automotive news.
Well, thank you, Robert.
Seasons are changing, but it's still a bit cold there on some days. And one of the things that's always a question is how does your range change in an electric vehicle when the weather gets colder? So I know that this is a subject that our listeners contact us with all the time. Tell us more.
Yeah, this is a great question, and it's so relevant right now because we have the new Chevrolet Bolt coming online, and early indications are that it's selling well, and with an advertised range of 238 miles, seems to answer the question a lot of people and the concerns that a lot of people had about electric vehicles. Likewise, the new Tesla Model 3 is reportedly coming online in the next few months, and that's going to have an advertised range over 210 miles. These sound like great ranges, but I want to caution people, if you live in the northern part of the country where it gets cold, you have to make some calculations for range. Here at Consumer Guide, we have been testing a Kia Soul EV. That's an electric Kia Soul, very likable vehicle. We're very happy with it. Its range, according to the EPA, is 93 miles. But this winter, as things got cold, it dipped as low as 58 miles.
That Ouch.
Is a 38% drop. Yeah, it is a significant drop. And for me, it was the difference between me taking the vehicle home or not taking the vehicle home from the office.
Or so taking it home and not getting home.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right, Robert. So the thing is this. Count on a drop of about 40% in range. And then you also have to allow that over the 5 years that you may own the vehicle, your range might drop another 5 or 10%. So knock off an even 40%, maybe 45%, worst case scenario, and that's your real world range.
Tom, since you're the guru of gears, give us a short explanation why weather decreases your range.
Yeah, and this is true of all batteries, but the lithium ion battery packs that are used in most electric vehicles are especially sensitive to temperature. In extremely hot temperature and in extremely cold temperature, their efficiency just drops. The chemical reaction doesn't like to happen. Additionally, if you're charging outside when it's cold, the charging will take more time. So yeah, it's just a question of the battery technology that's being used. And lithium ion batteries are proven to be very safe, very effective, and very long-lived. So in a lot of cases, they're great. But in very hot climates and in very cold climates, they have their limitations.
Well, let's talk a little bit about hot climates, because here in the Midwest, we suffer from both extremes, extreme cold and extreme heat. What kind of degradation in battery life and range are you going to see when it gets hot, and how hot does it need to get to see that degradation?
Yeah, pretty much if you start to see temperatures rise to the high 80s, you're going to see some degradation. The batteries seem to operate best in the mid-60s to low 70s. The degradation in hot weather is not as extreme or as immediate in cold weather. There is anecdotal evidence that suggests that the life of the battery in hot climates is not as long. But there isn't that much data out there, and I haven't read enough good stuff to suggest that that's absolutely true, but there's suggestion that that's true.
Anything on the horizon as far as technological advances that are going to combat weather and allow us to have a wider band in which batteries operate?
Yeah, what's happening, and it looks like most manufacturers are committed to lithium-ion technology, but what they're doing is they're going with new configurations where there are fewer cells within the battery that are larger, and that seems to help somewhat. Batteries now, as opposed to 5 years ago, are slightly more resilient in cold weather, and we can look for that to improve incrementally, I think, in years to come.
What about directing some of the car's heat to the battery to warm it up?
That's a great question, Robert, and that's actually done. The batteries are kept warm and cold while the vehicle is operating, but there's only so much that can be done. But yeah, there's actually a cooling and warming container around the battery.
Tom, is this why a lot of the new EVs are targeted to the California and Florida markets where the weather band is more consistent?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons. Out in California, you have the mandate, too, that a certain percentage of vehicles be electric or emissions-free. That's one reason. But ultimately, yeah, it's California, especially Southern California, perfect climate for batteries and EV vehicle.
Tom, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I always learn things. So thanks for being on. Thanks for being informative and entertaining, and we'll look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
That's Tom Appel. We've included a link to Consumer Guy's article on what we've been talking about in this week's show notes. Remember to subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com. Water Day took place earlier this spring to bring attention to water issues around the globe. To stay with that spirit, the humanitarian organization World Vision's behind another important day to bring attention to clean water, and we're joined by Laura Blank, Senior Advisor with World Vision. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I understand that you want us to understand that it's most likely that on average, people are walking 3.72 miles each day to get water. So your organization came up with this global 6K, which is going to happen in May.
Well, 6 kilometers, so it's 3.72 miles, as you said. It's about 15 laps around a track. So that helps us sort of visualize what that looks like. And that's the average distance that a child, typically a young girl or a woman, will have to walk every day in the developing world just to find water. And often they're making that walk and it's dirty water by the time they get there and bring it home. The walk might be dangerous. Many of times those children have to go find water for their families and they can't go to school because of that. So we're talking about something so basic to those of us who live here in the United States, but so critical to life for so many families around the world. So we've established the world's largest 6K walk for water. It's the global 6K for water. Like you said, it's happening on May 6th. And what we're hoping to do is rally people together to say, for your $50 registration fee, you can provide clean water to one person. And every step we take together is one that they won't have to.
When was the first 6K walk developed?
We started this a couple of years ago as a test, because a lot of people tell us at World Vision or at Team World Vision, which is our sort of arm of running races, Ironman, Comrades in South America, South Africa. These are races where you say, you know, my New Year's resolution is going to be doing a marathon this year. But a lot of people will say, I want to do something like that, but I just don't think I can do that distance. 6 kilometers, which is about 3.5 miles, is very doable. You can probably do that without much training. You can do it in probably an hour and 15 minutes, maybe an hour and a half, walking leisurely. So it's a distance that people can do that's manageable. And it's a one-time commitment as opposed to training for 4 or 5 months for a marathon. And then the value is you do that, you get some exercise, you get out with family and friends, and you're still doing something good for someone else too.
So this was first developed a couple of years ago as a test and a trial. What kind of participation did you have and how has it evolved into the event it is today?
So a couple of years ago, we had a few small, what we call host sites, those races where we just want to try it and see if people, if this resonates with anybody, if people really want to do this with us. Because, of course, at World Vision, we get really excited about it. I, as a mother of two young girls, get really excited thinking about how can I help other moms and other children like my children not have to walk for clean water every day. So just to give a point of comparison, last year when we did it, we had about 150 sites all over the world. And this year already, and we're still 2 months out from the race, we already have 500 sites around the world, which I'm so excited about. We're hoping to get even more as we get closer to the walk day, and I think we will. And so that's really exciting to just see how this idea is really catching on with people all over the world. The last time I looked at the map, we had registrations in Africa, in Brazil, in Japan, in Canada, in the United States. So it really is global.
Do they carry water when they walk?
You can. We don't make it a requirement. So all we ask is that you register and that you show up with your friends and family. When you register, you get a t-shirt and a participant's medal and a race bib, like you would if you were doing a 5K or a 10K street race. And on that bib is a picture of a child in our programs that you can choose to sponsor, or you can invite a friend or family to do that with you to help continue on that journey of providing clean water to a community. So it's really an exciting day. And the great thing about it is you can do it outside your front door. You can just walk 6K in your neighborhood, or you can do it with friends in the area and the community if there's a site near you.
Thanks for listening to Green Sense. My guest is Laura Blank, Senior Advisor with World Vision, and we're talking about the Global 6K Walk for Water. I'm Robert Colangelo. Let's talk a little bit about clean water trends and what you've seen out there, and how the 6K event has helped bring some awareness to water trends.
I think, you know, when we talk about issues of global significance, talking about poverty or the issue of clean water, I can tell you that 663 million people lack access to clean water. But that number is huge and it feels so far away. So I like to tell people that there is actually a lot of good news when it comes to providing clean water for people. 25 years ago, 1 out of every 4 people did not have access to clean water. But today, through a lot of this work that we're talking about here, 1 in every 10 people have water. And that number is getting smaller and smaller. So I just think it's so exciting to imagine what would it take for us to close that last 10%. So what could we do together to make sure that the remaining 10% of the people in the world had access to clean water? I mean, imagine what it could do. Children could go to school. Families wouldn't get sick. Mothers and fathers could provide for their children and provide this most basic essential need, which is clean water. I just think it's really exciting.
Well, the UN has tried for a long time to bring water to developing countries, but it hasn't been a success. What do you see that you can do different to make that successful?
Well, I think something that's really important, and in fact, we commissioned a study at the University of North Carolina because we wanted that third-party academic research, robust review of our work to say it's not us saying that this works well, but it's an academic institution who's going to look at it with an eye for data and for reliability and sustainability. So they did a study that found that 8 out of 10 wells that World Vision dug were still functioning at a high level, even 20 years after we dug them, which is very unusual, unfortunately, as you mentioned, when you talk about the situation with clean water and digging wells, which is part of what we do when we talk about providing access to clean water. But I think something that's really key is that when we go into a community, we don't just show up and dig a well. We start by having a conversation and asking that community, is this something you need? Where are local water points? What would you need? Where would you want this water point to be? What would you need to make it work for you? And then we train those community leaders that are selected by the community, not by us. We train them to maintain the well and fix the well. So it provides job training, but it also provides, it sort of institutionalizes this concept that this is their well. It's their water point. It's not something that we've done for them. It's something that we've done together. And I think that is really the key to the wells working 10 and 20 and even 30 years out.
So the difference is that you try to make the communities take ownership, understand the holistic part of the problem and where that well fits in as a solution. Is that fair to
say?
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, that's great. Absolutely.
Well, World Vision is a highly regarded charity, and it's pretty well run. 10% of your operating expenses go to fundraising, 6% to management, and the remaining 84% actually go to the people who you raise money to help around the world. What do you attribute those impressive numbers to?
You know, I think that that's something that we're really proud of, and financial accountability and transparency is something that we take very seriously because we run on the empathy and the kindness and the generosity of donors. So it's very important to us that anyone who's considering donating to us or even a long-term donor has a very clear understanding of how their money is going to good use. And so, yes, you mentioned our overhead rate. Of course, we have to have some money to turn the lights on and make sure that our staff can and do the work that they need to do. But besides that, we have regular conversations. We have a third party who audits us regularly. Our team is always talking about ways that that we can be good stewards of the financial resources in the same way that we talk about how can we be good stewards of the water resources that we have here in the United States. What can we do to conserve water and what can we do to help provide water to others?
Well, Laura, you really made me think today because now every time I go to the water cooler or go to the sink and I only take a few steps, I'm going to think about those people walking 6K every day. So thanks for raising awareness and thanks for being on Green Sense.
Thank you for having me.
Laura Blank, Senior Advisor with World Vision, telling us more about the Global 6K Walk for Water coming up on May 6th. You can learn more about it in this week's show notes. Subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast at iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com. As a kid, my mother told me one day that we would pay to watch TV and drink water. Well, I just didn't believe that that could be true. Now she tells me that in the very near future, robots will drive cars, and I learned that my mother's always right. Driverless cars, or autonomous vehicles, or AVs, will represent 15% of global sales by 2030. This is per a new report on AVs and how they're going to shape the lives in cities, especially those who are prepared for them. One of the authors of this new report called Driverless Future is Joseph Yakabuki, Director of Transit with Sam Schwartz Transportation Consultants. And we're lucky to have Joe here on the phone. Joe, glad you could join us.
Thanks, Robert. Great to be here.
Just like the Apple iPhone transformed society, I feel that the autonomous vehicle is the next big game-changing technology that will disrupt society. So I say bring it on. And if we compare that to the electric car, the electrification of cars happened about 15 years ago with hybrids and plug-in electrics, and we only have 1% of the cars on the road, or about 2 million cars. So you're predicting that AVs will be assimilated 15 times faster than the electric vehicle. Why do you think that change will happen so quickly?
Well, why we think that there's ripe for that change is that right now, you know, it's 80 to 90% of people own and drive their own vehicle for all their purposes, including work purposes. Their personally owned vehicles also have a high latent capacity, which is, sort of a fancy term for something that's not utilized very often. So you think of your car and you probably use it a half hour to 2 hours a day. And so it has about 22 hours a day for this very large purchase that you're not using that vehicle. We think that the big opportunity for autonomous vehicles is the opportunity to share vehicles, and whether that's you sharing it with your family or friends, or you actually subscribe to a network of a mobility as a service where you're sharing with individuals, it has potential for dramatic cost savings for transportation costs, which is where we sort of fit in with this paper and where we see that mass adoption taking place and really pushing the technology based on that cost factor.
Your new report focuses on how AVs will affect lives in cities and how cities need to be prepared. How will AVs improve city life?
It has the opportunity to improve city life. So an important premise is that there's going to be a major mode shift from people driving their own vehicles to being driven. And that has the opportunity to provide a lot of great amenities with cities. For instance, a third of our roadways, which is currently dedicated to parking and storage of vehicles, could be freed up for more active transportation uses like bike lanes, bus lanes, and really have an opportunity to increase optimization. On the other hand, it has the opportunity, you know, potentially if it's not managed correctly, to drive up vehicle miles traveled per person and further congest our roadways, or actually repeat a lot of the same issues that we've had in the 20th century with congestion in our roadways. So really what our paper sort of props up is that there's going to be a huge mode shift, and if cities get in front of this and manage this correctly, there's a huge opportunity to enhance optimization of our city roadways, but also inclusion, allowing more people to access the system and have lower household travel costs.
If you just joined us, you're listening to Green Sense, and my guest is Joseph Yakubuki, one of the authors of the new report called Driverless Future, and we're talking about how the autonomous vehicle will transform society if cities are ready. I'm Robert Colangelo. Well, something we've brought up, Joe, in the past is insurance. Who's at fault if an AV gets in an accident? Have you looked at that and what the cities have to do to prepare for that legal change?
No, we haven't necessarily looked deep into that issue, but I think it actually, you know, sort of gets to another issue that we raise here, which is, you know, the affordability of household travel costs when autonomous vehicles arrive, because we could actually go from a model where it's consumer priced insurance to actually a business or platform priced insurance, which would actually lower travel costs. So if for instance, if I currently drive my own vehicle today, I pay consumer price insurance, consumer price fuel, consumer price parking. In the future, if I'm part of a network of autonomous vehicles where I take the bus for some of my trips, the subway for some of my trips, and the autonomous vehicle for some of my trips, we have the opportunity to really lower my cost of transportation while providing all the same amenities of point-to-point amenities that my car would currently offer me versus actually taking somebody else providing that service for me.
Well, before the break, you mentioned that cities need to be prepared for this technology shift. You know, there's talk about a transportation bill and rebuilding America's crumbling infrastructure, and it takes a long time to pass these funds, and a lot of times they're geared towards existing technology. How do you see cities getting ahead of this issue and being able to divert funds, which are really scarce these days, to make the changes that you're predicting will be needed?
Yeah, that's probably the trillion-dollar question right now. And then with the latest budget discussions, it's still up in the air, you know, whether or not we're going to have a very large infrastructure investment. The truth regarding to that is that we're overdue for major infrastructure investment. And I won't necessarily get into the details. It's been quite codified pretty well by several publications, including ITE and other trade groups that have identified our crumbling infrastructure. But what I would say is that this potential mode shift allows us the potential to actually have a potential pricing structure where we could actually fund some infrastructure improvements, leveraging some of the technology, because we could potentially charge more for cars that are entering the central business district or downtown areas at certain times, and could tax that accordingly. One of our platforms for cities is to implement dynamic pricing, and that is just to say that if you're taking your own vehicle and in a very congested area at the peak times, that you should pay the price for doing that or the cause of congestion, as opposed to if you take the subway during that same time, you're actually incentivized to take that trip because it doesn't have any impact on the right of way.
London has done that. That hasn't gone over well. Great idea. We'll see. People don't like being taxed that way, so we'll see how that assimilates. But maybe you could talk a little bit more on what are some of the key concrete things that you think cities need to do to get ahead of this transportational mode change?
Sure. And actually, I will address that last question first, if you don't mind. The difference between driving your own vehicle and being driven, I think it actually provides an opportunity, because there will be a shift in perspective that you sort of understand if you're not driving your own vehicle, but you're being driven by a vehicle that is maybe part of a large network of vehicles moving everybody throughout our cities, that you would sort of understand that you would pay more if the trip takes longer, it's a more congested time period. So I think there could be an opportunity to look at things like dynamic pricing and congestion pricing without the sort of the public pushback of that, just because it's a matter of perspective as opposed to driving yourself as being driven. So that's the first part. The other elements that we mentioned in the report are, you know, one of the first things that cities really need to look at is some developments that are happening right now in Scandinavia and in Finland with developing a mobility as a service platform, which basically from the same platform, I can purchase several different types of trips, whether that's a transit trip, it's an Uber trip, it's a bike share trip, and I could pay for all those trips through the same platform. I think you'll see that being a major development, some of the first development with the technology today, even before we get to autonomous vehicles. Second, you know, we have to prioritize existing infrastructure, including public transit. Nothing has the ability to move the masses through our cities like mass transit. An 8-car subway train can move 1,000 people through a single point in a matter of seconds. So we need to double down on those technologies in order to ensure that we have the optimization for our cities. Then we outline other things here. You know, our partners, I should just mention, are Arcadis and HRNA, who do large engineering projects and real estate and policy advisory, respectively, between the two organizations. And one of the unique things about our report is it's not necessarily just on transportation, but we also make recommendations for land use, you know, planning for mixed-use car-like neighborhoods, and also looking at when you're building parking structures, making sure that those structures are adaptable and can basically be converted to other uses like office or residential.
That's Joseph Yakubuki, Director of Transit with Sam Schwartz Transportation Consultants, talking about the driverless future. I'm Robert Colangelo, reminding you to subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of Green Sense. And we'll be back next week with...
You know, innovation seems to come from seemingly anywhere and almost everywhere. How about we make tires out of tomato skins and eggshells that we'd normally throw away? We'll meet the scientists behind the idea.
Subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play by visiting greensensefarms.com. And you can also see a list of radio stations that air our show. Our goal is to be an honest broker of sustainable information so that you can make informed decisions. To do that, you got to stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan at GreenSense Farms, the largest indoor commercial vertical farm in the world. We walk the walk and talk the talk, growing leafy green vegetables 24/7, free of pesticides, herbicides, with non-GMO seeds, conserving resources, and reducing waste. Watch us grow. The program is copyright Green Sense Farms, all rights reserved.